The Trump administration has expanded its travel ban to include 6 more countries with substantial Muslim populations.
Consistency is the use of a national security pretext as a blunt instrument to keep out large numbers of people.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and today on The Takeaway for February 3rd, we'll check in on the effects this ban will have. Also on the podcast, we look into the sensitive subject of miscarriage and why it's been so hard for women to talk about.
We haven't been totally honest with women in the things we've told them about their prenatal care all the way from the 1920s till today, for 100 years.
And while the Iowa caucus is coming out as full steam, a look at how folks there are dealing with childcare, while also determining who will run for president on the Democratic side of things. And finally, we speak with filmmaker Taika Waititi about using humor to tell a story set in Nazi Germany in his film Jojo Rabbit.
As for comedy, it's always been a really effective tool for dealing with ideologies that threaten to ruin humanity, I guess.
A lot to get to. Let's get started. With President Donald Trump's all but certain acquittal by the Senate dominating the news cycle late over the weekend, one big story flew under the radar. On Friday, 3 years after he first announced his controversial travel ban, President Trump expanded it to include 6 new countries: Nigeria, Eritrea, Tanzania, Sudan, Kyrgyzstan, and Myanmar. The original travel ban barred almost all immigrants and travelers to the U.S. from 7 majority Muslim nations, including Iran, Libya, and Yemen. It was met with widespread outrage at home and abroad, spurring massive protests at airports across the United States.
Hey, hey, JFK, no fascist USA, no hate, no fear.
This time around, immigrant communities are once again scrambling to understand how they'll be affected in the weeks and months ahead. But overall, the public response has been more muted. Under the expanded ban, the U.S. will stop issuing visas that would lead to permanent residency for nationals of countries like Myanmar and Nigeria, while also suspending diversity visas to those from Sudan and Tanzania. When the expanded ban goes into effect later this month, the total number of countries affected will be 13. And though the original ban was challenged in the courts, the Supreme Court ultimately upheld it in June of 2018. Joining me now is Faiza Patel, co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Faiza, thanks for coming back on the program.
My pleasure.
And also with us is Nicole Narea, immigration reporter for Vox. Nicole, hi.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Faiza, have you been bracing for this expansion?
Yes. I mean, there have been news reports for the last several weeks that an expansion was coming. And obviously, it was the 3rd anniversary of the Muslim ban early last week. So we were expecting that something would come out around this time. And that's exactly what happened.
So how was this expansion consistent with or distinct from the earlier set of countries?
So the consistency is the use of a national security pretext as a blunt instrument to keep out large numbers of people, mostly from Muslim countries and African countries. It is clearly targeted at certain populations that this administration doesn't like and doesn't want to have in this country. And when you look at the rationale for the ban in the proclamation, which formalized it, it's quite similar to what we saw when the final reports around the Muslim ban were actually done, which is that they take these very sort of neutral-seeming criteria, such as, you know, cooperation with the U.S., whether or not a country issues electronic passports, whether it reports lost and stolen passports to Interpol, and then they apply them selectively because there's loads of countries in the world, including countries like China and India, which don't meet those criteria, but they just pick, you know, these 6 or 7.
Well, we've seen a Nigerian-American, Karen Attia, at the Washington Post, who tweeted out, "Nigeria being added to Trump's travel and immigration restriction list has nothing to do with religion, national security, or logic, or sane foreign policy. Remember when Trump said that once Nigerians see the U.S., they would, quote, never go back to their huts? It's about racism." Do you agree with her?
Absolutely. And I think what it's about is also overstay rates, right? So this administration is very concerned about people overstaying their non-immigrant visas. Nigeria actually has a fairly high rate of overstays on Nigerian citizens coming to the U.S. And that's why it's actually particularly odd, because if you're worried about overstay rates, why are you restricting immigrant visas, which have nothing to do with overstay rates? It's just another demonstration of the lack of logic behind this.
Explain this distinction you're making.
Sure. So for a long time, one of the big concerns of this administration and previous administrations, for that matter, is that people will come to the U.S., say, on a tourist visa or some kind of other short-term visa, and then they'll overstay. They'll stay back. They might start working. They might enter into a relationship, etc. And that's, you know, one of the big components of people who are here with that documentation. And Nigeria is one of the countries that does have a fairly significant overstay rate. And that reason was given by sort of anonymous administration officials along the way. But if you're concerned about, you know, non-immigrants staying on, then restricting immigrant visas, which is what this ban does, so people who want to move here mostly to be with family or to take up a job, doesn't really make any sense because it doesn't deal with the overstay problem.
Nicole, it was pretty surprising to see Nigeria on the list. I mean, it is a very big country, close to 200 million people. It's also been a U.S. ally in the fight against terrorism, correct?
Yeah. Nigerians also make up a huge population of African immigrants living in the U.S. They're numbering some 327,000 in the U.S. But yeah, they have been a partner to the U.S. in counterterrorism efforts on the ground against Boko Haram. So it's sort of confusing as to why the Trump administration would try to penalize Nigeria for working with their U.S. counterparts to combat domestic homegrown terrorism.
Tell us more about what you know about the Nigerian diaspora. They are, to my mind, they are highly educated and fairly high income here in America, correct?
Yeah. They're among some of the most successful immigrants in the U.S. The cities that have some of the largest populations include Dallas, Chicago, Baltimore, Atlanta, Phoenix, and Houston. And Houston actually has the largest Nigerian population outside Brazil and Africa. And every year, the U.S. does grant Nigerians significant numbers of green cards. In 2018, it was almost 14,000. By comparison, citizens from the other countries that are included in this expansion of the travel restrictions were granted a combined total of less than 6,000. So these restrictions really are having an outsized effect on Nigerians, many of whom have family back in Nigeria and might be tempted to bring them over to the U.S. And reunite. But now that won't be feasible under these new restrictions.
So we're talking about a lot of skilled workers here in the U.S. who will be affected by this?
Yes, absolutely. Most of these people who are able to obtain green cards are working in the workforce. They're, skilled workers. They're being granted H-1B visas, which are for particularly skilled workers, oftentimes in technology fields. So, this is definitely going to affect skilled immigration, legal immigration, in a way that the Trump administration hasn't exactly communicated.
How is this being received by Nigerians here in the U.S.?
I think there's just an overwhelming sense of why me, especially because Nigerians are actively contributing to U.S. society and there is a huge diaspora in the U.S. They find that these travel restrictions are kind of being arbitrarily applied to Nigeria because many other countries that aren't included on the new list would have some of the same national security failings that Nigeria has. So it really does feel like a targeted restriction and one that's discriminatory. And that's why a lot of immigrant advocates are now calling this an African ban.
Faiza, what do you make of the timing of this announcement?
Well, I mean, the timing's not a coincidence. I think, you know, it's interesting to me that, you know, we sit and we analyze, you know, the little pieces of this ban and the justifications that they gave. But this ban is just a messaging ban in some sense for this administration, right? It comes on the heels of, you know, the 3-year anniversary of the Muslim ban. It's telling the president's supporters, look, I'm keeping black and brown people out of the country. It's, you know, an election year, obviously. And this is, I think, him delivering on his anti-immigrant agenda for his supporters.
So there are no countries that are, predominantly non-brown, meaning white countries that have been affected by these bans, correct?
None. In fact, Belarus was floated as being an additional country that would be in this version of the ban, but in the end it wasn't there. So it was the usual suspects in a way.
What are we hearing from the people in leadership in these countries that are targeted by expansion? I mean, is the leadership in Nigeria or Eritrea, are they fighting this?
Well, certainly the Nigerian government has been quite vocal about saying, look, you know, we didn't even expect this to happen. We had no idea we would be on this ban, which is really interesting because if you the State Department has said, and it's reflected in the document, that they had extensive consultations with officials from all of these countries before, in order to give them an opportunity to improve the situation before they implemented this. And that's clearly at odds with what the Nigerian government is saying. I think you have to also understand that, you know, most countries are not in a strong position vis-a-vis the United States. They want a lot from the U.S. This is one piece of what they want. Nigeria, obviously, is a large and populous country, and it can actually say something. So I'm not surprised that we're not hearing more from other countries, because these are fairly small countries which don't have a huge ability to stand up to the United States.
Now, we heard earlier in the segment the audio of people flooding JFK Airport, protesting the original travel ban. But of course, the Supreme Court did decide in Trump administration's favor. Is there a sense that basically this is sort of settled matter?
So, I mean, to be clear, what the Supreme Court did was to say that the injunction against the travel ban was not upheld, right? So it had been enjoined by the lower courts. That is to say that they said you can't implement this. And that does require a preliminary review of whether or not it is constitutionally valid. And the Supreme Court said, no, you can't enjoin this ban because we're not that clear that it's unconstitutional. The litigation against the Muslim ban is continuing. In fact, just last week, we had oral argument in the Fourth Circuit down in Richmond, Virginia on the ban. So that's definitely still a somewhat open issue.
So could this new expansion affect those proceedings?
I don't think so, not directly at least, because that is about a particular presidential proclamation and it's about a particular policy. But I think the important thing here is that we shouldn't be relying on the courts again and again to block the Trump administration, because one of the things we see is that oftentimes the lower courts, the trial courts and the appellate courts have been a pretty good wall against some of his most outrageous moves. But when we get to the Supreme Court, we've lost several times. So I think it's really important for Congress to step up to the plate over here. I understand that, you know, there is a bill called the No Ban Act, which would actually reverse the Muslim ban and make it more difficult for the president to take these kinds of arbitrary decisions in the future. And it has the support of almost every Democrat in the House. And I believe a vote is scheduled on that within the next week or two.
Nicole, we do have to wrap up pretty soon, but do you expect protests along the lines of what we saw at JFK 3 years ago to be playing out in the coming days?
I think, unfortunately, people's ability to have outrage is limited under the Trump administration. We really just haven't seen protesters coming out against Trump administration immigration policies since really the separation of immigrant families. So I'm not really anticipating that among everything else that's happening with impeachment and now with the primary starting, there's unfortunately intention on a lot of other news events and not on this development.
Nicole Narea is an immigration reporter for Vox, and Faiza Patel is the co-director of the Brennan Center's Liberty and National Security Program. Thank you both for joining us today.
Thanks.
Thanks.
We're going to talk now about something that a lot of people experience, but many fewer talk about openly: the loss of a pregnancy.
I miscarried my first pregnancy, and that was now a long time ago, about 17 years ago. Before I had my two children, I was shocked. It was really distressing. And then when I started looking into it, I found that, in fact, miscarriages were very common. I had a first trimester miscarriage, and about 20% of confirmed pregnancies miscarry, usually in their early months.
That's Lara Friedenfelds, a historian of health, reproduction, and parenting, and the author of The Myth of the Perfect Pregnancy, A History of Miscarriage in America. Studies show that 1 in 4 women in the U.S. and the U.K. will experience a miscarriage. But as common as they are, many women have trouble finding the support they need to cope. But that might be starting to change. In recent months, public figures from Beyoncé Knowles to Alanis Morissette have been speaking out about pregnancy loss and how it's personally affected them. And that might be opening up more conversations about miscarriage and how it continues to be difficult to talk about and therefore difficult to find help dealing with. I asked Lara Friedenfels to talk us through all of this, including her own miscarriage experience.
Part of what was really shocking was that I was about to receive my PhD in the history of science. I had written this dissertation that would become my book, The Modern Period, Menstruation in 20th Century America. If anyone should have known this statistic and understood what might happen, it was me. And somehow I had missed that information, and I feel like actually it was fairly hidden. It's not a matter of that you're in poor health or that you've done something wrong. Most miscarriages actually happen because of chromosomal problems with the embryo. And so they can happen to anyone. And I wish the doctor had said to me, just so you know, you may get pregnant next month. It may take 6 months. You may have a great, easy pregnancy the first time, or it may not stick the first time. But that's okay. That's all within the range of healthy women's childbearing. It's unfortunately how it goes, but I think everything looks great and I wish you well. If someone had said it that way to me, I think I would have gone in with a different expectation and it would have really helped me make peace quickly with the situation.
At what point during a pregnancy is a miscarriage most likely to occur?
They're more likely the earlier you are in the pregnancy. So one way to not have the experience, in fact, is to just wait to take that pregnancy test. So if you test the earliest the pregnancy test manufacturers tell you you can, which is almost a week before you've missed your period, if you test then and you get the faintest glimmers of the human chorionic gonadotropin that you're measuring with that test, you have a 30% chance of miscarrying. That test is not telling you what people feel like it should tell them, which is that I have a baby on the way in 9 months. It's telling you you have a 70% chance of a baby on the way in 9 months. So what I tell women is you might feel better just waiting to take that test because a bunch of the losses you won't even know you had if you didn't take the test.
And I guess for many people, when they're having a miscarriage, it may be at home or in some other place. They're not necessarily having under care of a medical professional, correct?
Yes. So part of the important thing to understand about miscarriage is that the experience can be very different depending on what stage of the pregnancy you have the miscarriage. So like I was saying, in the first few weeks, you may not even be able to tell the difference between a miscarriage and a late menstrual period, especially if you get crampy periods. Menstrual cramps are related to childbirth pain, and there's a whole continuum there. Whereas if you had even a first trimester loss, if it's at the very end of the first trimester, you may have almost the experience of a mini childbirth. It can be really painful and difficult and scary.
Typically, what happens for someone in that situation in terms of getting the kind of care or counseling that they may need?
I think many women, if they start to bleed, will seek medical care. May end up at the emergency room or with their obstetrician. And the care that women receive these days is, I would say, hit or miss. It depends on the hospital and it depends on the practitioner. Some practitioners are very compassionate about it, can explain well what's going on. I think a really good practitioner will tell a woman what to expect. Often they do send women home and tell them to come back if they have alarming symptoms, but that they may be more comfortable and safer miscarrying in the comfort of their own home. We're still trying to figure out how to give women the emotional support they need in any birth situation, including if they end up having a miscarriage.
So it's very common, and yet you have all these studies which continue to show that women say they have a hard time talking about the miscarriage to even closest friends. Why is that?
I think it can be really risky to talk about miscarriage. So we know that despite the laws we have against discrimination against pregnant women and mothers, that we face those issues at work. So it can feel risky to talk about miscarriage with anyone who might affect our employment. It can feel risky because actually women have a range of responses to miscarrying. So some women feel profound distress, feel almost like they've lost a child, even if it's a very early loss, while others feel that it's a lost opportunity, a disappointment, and they're eager to try again. And those are really different emotional reactions. And even very well-meaning friends and family members may assume one or the other and just say the wrong thing.
Is there anything that can be done prior to someone becoming pregnant that would conceivably reduce the trauma from potentially experiencing a miscarriage?
I think so. So as a historian, what I see is that our contemporary childbearing culture does a lot to aggravate the problem. So what I see is that, first of all, we believe, as you said earlier, that we have way more control than we actually do over our fertility and over being able to stay pregnant, over how much the things that we do to care for our pregnancies actually can make a difference. By the time we had the birth control pill, boy, we felt like we had it all under control. And in many ways, we did in terms of preventing pregnancy, but that can make you feel overconfident that you have control when you do want to be pregnant. We've had wonderful medical care develop. By the 1950s, we could be much more confident in the safety of our pregnancies. And we also developed a culture of maternity care where women were told that if they would just do the right things, they would have safe and healthy pregnancies. And women were told this even by practitioners who knew that this was not true about early pregnancy loss. But there was still a feeling that it helped to say reassuring things and that maybe we would get there. And we haven't been totally honest with women in the things we've told them about their prenatal care all the way from the 1920s till today for 100 years. We have a culture that I think can be very positive in many ways about how we think about parenting. Our pregnancy advice, which already was over-promising, I think, is increasingly brought to us by marketers. Mm-hmm. And they're not trying to sell us healthy pregnancies. They're trying to sell us stuff for our pregnancies, for our children, for all the different life choices we're going to make now that we have children. It's not just the baby clothes. It's also the minivan, the life insurance policy. And with that advice, with our pregnancy advice coming via those marketers, their incentive is to get us excited about our pregnancies and bonded with our pregnancies, because that's what's going to induce us to start buying their things and attaching to their brands first before someone else gets to you as the pregnant customer. And I think recognizing just how much marketing is framing the pregnancy advice, the marketing is framing what we learn about embryos. When if we download an app, we get our daily update, this is your baby on day 56. If it's a marketing mechanism to get you to log in daily for that picture, then the way that they're telling you about your pregnancy may or may not be objective or in your best interest.
Laura Friedenfels is a PhD historian of health, reproduction, and parenting, and the author of The Myth of the Perfect Pregnancy, A History of Miscarriage in America. Laura, thanks for joining me.
Thank you so much.
We asked you to share your stories of miscarriage, and so many of you weighed in.
This is Lorna Lynn calling from Wynwood, Pennsylvania, outside of Philadelphia. I had a miscarriage at age 39 when my husband and I deeply wanted a second child to join our four-year-old daughter. It was emotionally devastating. The best support I got was from my mother, who had had two miscarriages herself. While I was only about 8 to 10 weeks along in that pregnancy, I already loved the baby and was so sad to lose that child. Friends and family who had not experienced a similar loss were not helpful. They didn't seem capable of understanding that this was a real, profound loss of someone I had begun to love and wanted to welcome.
This is Karen from Cherry Hill. Having a miscarriage, several actually, was one of the most isolating experiences of my life. Even though almost everyone I know has had one, people seem to say the most horrendous things. It was God's plan. You can have another. It could have been worse. It feels like no one, not even your husband, can possibly understand your pain, even though probably most people can empathize.
My name is Vinca Valdivia. I'm calling from San Diego, California. And this is a touchy subject. My sister had a miscarriage right around the time that we were both pregnant together. I'm sure it was especially sad for her because we had planned on raising our kids at around the same age and having them grow up together. Although we never really talked about it afterwards, it couldn't have been easy for her to watch my pregnancy grow as she had lost her child.
My name is Lindsay from Florida. I miscarried an unplanned pregnancy when I was 28 years old. Even though I had planned to terminate the pregnancy at my local Planned Parenthood, I still was really troubled by this feeling that something was wrong with my body, that it was malfunctioning in some way at an age where I was supposed to be super healthy.
It's Leanne from Pacific Palisades. I've held space with girlfriends and significant others in the wake of miscarriages and even an early delivery that led to mortality of two twins. The best you can do is just be with them, support them, look around and see how you might help them practically, like tidying or cooking or getting their mail. And you really have to wait for their words and just show them affection until they're ready to talk.
My name's Nicole, calling from Columbia, South Carolina. I've had two miscarriages in the past few years, which I decided to be pretty open about. And I was really surprised and encouraged by how many women shared that same experience and were so willing to offer support and understanding.
Thanks so much to all of you who told us your stories. If you do want to share your experience, we're at 877-8-MY-TAKE.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
I'm Helga Davis, and my show is all about the art of fearless conversation.
The wonder of dialogue is that what you think is so obvious gets really questioned at a deep level.
Sometimes the truth is having those uncomfortable discussions that get to facts that we usually don't want to talk about.
Join me for a new season of Helga, wherever you get podcasts.
I'm Arun Venugopal, and we've got one more story to round out the hour here on The Takeaway. Filmmaker Taika Waititi frequently pops up on screen in the movies he writes and directs, usually playing an endearingly goofy character, whether it's a nearly 400-year-old vampire in What We Do in the Shadows.
So it's 6 p.m. in the nighttime, which is when I wake up. This is always a really scary part for me.
Or a friendly alien in Thor Ragnarok.
Allow me to introduce myself. My name is Korg. I'm kind of like the leader in here. I'm made of rocks, as you can see, but don't let that intimidate you. You don't need to be afraid unless you're made of scissors. Just a little rock, paper, scissor joke for you.
When I sat down with him recently, he brought some of that same energy into the studio. Taika Waititi. I'm sorry?
Sorry, what?
Oh, okay. Mm-hmm. I was just going to introduce you. No. I don't have to.
Is this the intro?
It's unnecessary.
I'm not going to introduce you.
Just go straight into it.
Okay, let's do it.
Yeah, do that
Taika
first.
Taika Waititi.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, thank you. Taika Waititi is the writer, director, and star of...
Oh, star of...
Jojo Rabbit. But Jojo Rabbit represents a bit of a departure for him. It's a satire set in Nazi Germany, and the main character, Jojo, is a 10-year-old member of the Hitler Youth. The role that Taika has given to himself this time around is Jojo's imaginary friend, Adolf Hitler.
He's conjured from the mind of a 10-year-old boy, so he can only know what a 10-year-old boy knows. So he's an idiot, and I think that's why you can actually bear to have him in these scenes. If we had gone with an actual real actor, someone who could act and was proud of it, I think they'd put too much effort in. I think they would have researched Hitler. I think they would have studied him. And I think that he doesn't deserve that. I think that gives him too much power.
Using humor to talk about the Nazis, even when it's being used to take them down, is a risky approach. But the work seems to have connected. Taika won Best Adapted Screenplay from the Writers Guild of America and the BAFTAs over the weekend. Up next are the Oscars, where the film is nominated for 6 awards, including Best Picture. And while Taika acknowledges the sensitivity of the subject matter, he says his goal was not to make a provocative movie.
I have no idea how to make a drama. I mean, that's the reason I try to do it in my own style. And if you look at my other films, tonally, they all have that balance. You know, it skirts the line between comedy and drama, and it comes backwards and forwards, and it doesn't lead the audience by the hand and set them up for the dramatic parts by easing them into it for 10 minutes of the film. Sometimes it's just like that, you know, and it just happens, boom. And it's a surprise for people. And I feel like that's truer to life. I think the mixture of comedy and drama is the human experience. That's what life is. That's what every day is like for every single person. You know, you go between laughing and crying and fury and rage and jealousy and then back to love and then back to hate. And that's who we are. And I love seeing that mixture in films. And as for comedy and using comedy with the subject matter, it's always been a really effective tool for dealing with bullies and with ideologies that threaten to ruin humanity, I guess. And look, I really think that a lot of the great dramatic films about the Holocaust and about World War II, they have their place in the history of this topic, and they're extremely important, and I think we all know the films. Personally, that's not the way that I feel like I can approach a film like that, because I don't know if I really have the emotional tools to be able to just do a drama. But I will say that when people assume, and a lot of the critics, I think, of this film haven't seen the film, which I've come to learn, is that people will criticize the film because they've assumed a certain thing about it, that we're using jokes and making Nazis funny, which is not what's happening in the film at all, if you see the film. What we're doing is trying to pick away the threads at a regime and at a way of thinking, and really just focusing in on the ridiculousness of this kind of stuff, of bigotry and basically focusing on the ridiculousness of racism, which is, when you step back from it, it is a preposterous idea. It's ludicrous and it's absurd. And so part of what we do is, you know, when you look at things like I think in a lot of dramas about this time, the Nazis are painted as this sort of elite, most organized, efficient. I mean, they're almost like the Empire in Star Wars, you know, like everything's always perfect and there's something to be feared. I think the issue with that is, and yes, they, you know, were bullies and they were calculating and they were responsible for millions of people dying. But I think personally, if we continue to do that and paint them this way, then we continue to fear them. And I don't want to do that. I want to laugh at them. I want to take the power away from them. And by focusing on how stupid a lot of the parts of that regime was, that for me makes me feel stronger around the image of them and the way I think about them. And focusing on how stupid their uniforms were, you know, the fact that, you know, the uniforms looked like they were designed by 11-year-old boys. You look at every part of all the insignia on their hats, they had a skull and crossbones. And then on their belts, they had lightning bolts, and they had eagles on their shirts and wolves. And when you look at all those things combined, you think, oh, they just wanted to be cool. They just that's what they wanted. They wanted people to fear them. But when you look at all those things, it's ridiculous. I mean, they kind of thought themselves as sort of Viking pirates. Yeah, and if you look at Hitler and you know, and you can take away all of these things, all that power by by focusing on the fact that he looked like an idiot with that stupid moustache and his silly hats and his big hipped pants and his tight boots. And when you step back and look at him, he looked like a clown. And I like doing that. I like kind of taking the power back from these people because they're just humans. And it's not just one Nazi that the world should be afraid of. The fact that they were so effective is because there were enough of them. Enough of them got brainwashed, and enough of them believed in this ridiculous idea. And that's where the fear that comes from. It's the fact that an entire country can be swept away in this frenzy and this groupthink.
Is this something that you feeling, say, in New Zealand as well? That kind of groupthink? Is that happening?
Not so much. New Zealand, it's a wonderful place. So it's more any racism that's there that we experience in New Zealand, and I'm just coming from my background is indigenous, so Māori on my father's side, and on my mother's side, the origins are Russian Jews. And the Jewish communities, when I was growing up, it was quite small. And so, but I don't think growing up in the 80s, many kids knew what a Jew was. So I didn't really experience anything on that side. But mainly because I'm brown, it would be racism towards Polynesians and brown people. And it's definitely there, but it's not like masses of people. There aren't that many. I think New Zealand is still a place where if a group of people got together and tried to do that, most people in New Zealand would crush them.
There was this, I guess, these really striking scenes for me after the Christchurch massacre of seeing all these young people do Maori dances. And these images were kind of transmitted all the world, and they felt like something I would never see here in the U.S., people kind of taking this great pride in indigenous culture, even people who weren't Maori, evidently.
Yeah, and it was actually every culture and a lot of other religions coming to support the Muslim community after that tragedy. And it was not only Maori, but many people from different factions and different parts of society and different religions would come down to the mosques in the weeks following and stand vigil and stand guard around the mosques. You had Christians, everyone, and including Polynesians as well. And it was it was great to see that something that was designed and that an act that was designed to break us, to pull us apart, actually unified the country in a really, really amazing way, and that actually created a huge amount of love and understanding. And I was really proud of my country at that point.
I want to speak about a couple of your other movies. What was the experience like trying to get financial support in New Zealand for movies about Indigenous people?
I can't speak for other people, but it was easy for me because I'm New Zealand's golden boy of cinema. And, well, there are definitely struggles in trying to make films in New Zealand, but women have it the hardest. And female directors in New Zealand have, just like anywhere else, have got are fighting the biggest fight to get their films made and their stories made. We do make a decent amount of stuff that deals with the Indigenous experience. I had it a little easier than most because the very first short film I made, which was was set in an Indigenous community where I'm from, about some kids waiting for their parents in a car outside a pub. It's called Two Cars, One Night. And that was my first film, and it got nominated for an Oscar. And then after that, they basically let me do whatever I wanted. So I got to make those films that I wanted, my feature films, and they pretty much left me alone. And not in a way where, the danger is you get too many yes people around you, and they say yes to any idea you have. I still have a community of people that I work with and peers and creative people who will challenge me, but it's more that the people who pay for the movies, which is the New Zealand Film Commission, were, I guess, supportive enough of me and knowing that my process could be trusted, that they would just give me the money and let me do it.
How does the fact that there is a big audience for these kinds of stories you've made in New Zealand square with the way that the history of colonization is actually taught in New Zealand?
There's a big drive growing up in New Zealand for educators to teach kids about what happened, about New Zealand's history. There's nothing that's really brushed over. It used to be the case that the colonial system wasn't really interested in people learning about what they'd done or what they'd stolen. But now it's very you can't avoid it in schools. And for me, growing up in, you know, in the 80s and 90s, everyone knew about it, and it was something you studied. And it was it's information that's very readily available, and it's always and it's often readily shared between people. So most people would grow up having some idea about the treaty that our current system and New Zealand as we know it was founded on, and the discrepancies between two versions of the treaty, and how it is a legally binding document, but there are still a lot of things that haven't been honoured within that document, which means that the Māori have had the short end of the stick, and we've lost a lot of land and lost a lot of rights over the years. You know, each government that comes in is trying to rectify that and trying to make amends, some better than others. But yeah, it's something you're very aware of, and no one hides it in New Zealand.
You went from a very small budget film like What We Do in the Shadows to, within 2 or 3 years, you're making Thor Ragnarok, which is like more than 100 times as big a budget, right? What was that transition like, going from something so small and intimate and quirky to a huge film that was also quirky in many ways, but was it just like a system that you're worried you get eaten alive by?
For about 5 minutes, I thought, this is going to be such a shock to my system, and how am I going to make that transition? But then I realized that there must have been a reason for them choosing me to do this film. And I know it's not because of my experience in superhero movies or action films. It's because of the way I see the world and the characters that I create and the stories that I tell. And that's a very unique style and a unique way of telling stories. And that's what Marvel, to their credit, often do with the directors that they bring in. They're usually people who don't necessarily need to have had any experience. You know, the Russo brothers had done Community when they came in. I mean, they were comedy directors. And, you know, now they've done Endgame and Civil War, which was something you never would have expected, which is not to say that, you know, no one believed that they could do it. It's just something that's so – what's great about what Marvel are doing is that they're just defying expectations all the time, and I think that's what happened with me. They brought me in and gave me the tools to make this film, and I felt comfortable knowing that, because my one was like maybe the 18th film or 17th film that they had made, that they knew what they were doing. I knew what I was doing with the things that I'd come in to do. And I think that, you know, I felt like, okay, well, it's going to be a good collaboration, and I'm here to support them, and, you know, with their franchise, and they're very much there to support these filmmakers that they bring in. For me, the big difference is really just time. It just takes a lot more time to do stuff, because, and even just simply on set takes a long time, because there's another, you know, 300 more people involved than what I would have on my films. And yeah, and the food is better sometimes. But craft services. Outside of that, it's the exact same process. When I'm working, everything around, all those hundreds of people in the periphery and behind me, they all disappear. And it's all about just recreating human moments that are hopefully believable within a rectangle. And you have actors. And it doesn't matter if they're on a film that costs $100,000 or a film that costs $150,000. They're trying to do the same thing. They're trying to be believable and remember their lines and say the lines fast. And as a director, you're just trying to give them the space to achieve that. Sometimes the lines are different and they're talking about these weird mythological things and, you know, and powers and all this sort of stuff. And other times they're talking about growing up in a native community in New Zealand and, you know, and where they're going to get money to buy a pack of cigarettes. But the intention is always there, and everyone has that same intention, creating some truth on screen and telling a damn good story.
We have to wrap up, but I do want to ask one last question. You're planning on shooting the next Thor movie in Australia, which has obviously been experiencing these massive wildfires. Do you think filmmakers need to take climate change into account more, both in terms of where you're shooting, but also in terms of subject matter?
Yeah. I mean, again, I think, you know, like, not every every film dealing with World War II has to take you to a camp. You know, definitely can't be forgotten and needs to be addressed. But, you know, and I appreciate films that deal with things like climate change. This film deals with a lot of things, and it's the thing about these scripts is they are constantly changing. And also, it's quite, what's fun about doing these films is you get to sort of seed in these ideas and things that you don't want them to be too obvious or too on the nose. But you know, the Indigenous experience was something that we subtly would put into the last Thor film, and I think what's really important for every film crew going anywhere in the world is to identify, acknowledge, thank, and also try to involve local tribes, whoever the Indigenous presence are in that area where you're shooting. I think it's vital, and I think it's just plain politeness just to actually find those people and say, hey, we have the intention of shooting here on your ancestral grounds. You know, can you please welcome us in your traditional way? And that's what I do on all my films, is get the local Indigenous people to come and do that. And we had a welcome to country ceremony on Thor Ragnarok in Australia with the Yugambi tribe. And it just opens up the whole thing in a really beautiful, peaceful way. And when everyone comes in with good intentions, and then just good things happen. You know, it sets you up for success. You got to do it.
Taika Waititi is the writer, director, and star of Jojo Rabbit. Taika, thank you so much.
Well, thank you. Cheers.
Democratic candidates have been vying for the 2020 presidential nomination for well over a year now. And today, voters will finally get to weigh in during Iowa's caucuses. But many parents in the state, especially women who want to caucus today, will run into a familiar problem: childcare. And despite the childcare gap closing in recent years, women are still 8 times more likely than fathers to be the primary caretaker of children in heterosexual relationships. And unlike in traditional primaries where voters just cast a ballot, caucuses are long, complicated, and public processes. People gather in places like schools or libraries to convince members of the community to support their preferred candidate.
The caucuses are basically like gathering all your friends and neighbors into a big gymnasium or church basement and moving your body from corner to corner to vote for the Democratic candidate that you want to be the presidential nominee.
And that is
Liz Lenz. I am a columnist for the Cedar Rapids Gazette.
Liz recently spoke with several women in Iowa about how difficult it can be for them as parents to participate in this process.
Everybody's got a different solution. Some are bringing their kids. Some are hiring babysitters, but some are just staying home altogether because, you know, their kids might not be able to be with the sitter. Some have high needs kids. Some have tiny little babies who are still breastfeeding, you know, and so it's really so many people have so many different workarounds to this problem.
Recently, the issue of childcare has become visible enough that candidates are taking steps to solve it themselves.
Some campaigns are actually trying to work out babysitters and having on-site babysitting, which is great, but it is, again, not a full solution to all parents because some parents don't trust, you know, a stranger to babysit their child. So there's just a lot of ways parents are trying to figure this out.
And it's not just a matter of childcare. For many women, the very public nature of the caucus is a barrier too.
For women who are in abusive situations or are in more stressful marriages, it can be just compounded, you know, by the public nature of the vote, by who's responsible for childcare, by who's willing to take that step and do, you know, these public voting processes. And I think it's just all those little individual stories that add up to the silencing of so many women in Iowa.
For more on the national barriers to political participation for women, we turn to Kelly Dittmar, assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University and scholar at the Center for American Women and Politics. Kelly, thanks for coming on the show.
Thanks for having me.
So these problems in Iowa, this is just one example of the institutional barriers to women's political involvement, correct?
Yeah, I mean, I think we have to think about the origins of our political system and realize that these were institutions built for and by men. And so we see different structures, different rules, different norms and practices that have really advantaged and made life easier for men when it comes to not only just political participation, but of course, running for winning office and holding elective office.
Is this basically the, the catch-22 that you don't have more women in higher office who can advocate for allowing more women to participate in the process?
Well, I mean, like I said, I think we have to be careful in the sense that the barriers to broad participation, women have really pushed through, right? Mm-hmm. So the fact that, again, women are the most reliable voters, even in the Iowa caucuses tonight, women will very likely outnumber men. Part of that, I think, is due to women's really persistence. You know, nevertheless, she persisted. Women have figured out how to push through some of the barriers. One of the things to consider, of course, is what would happen if those barriers went down? You might see even greater participation, activity, engagement, et cetera, from women, and especially at those levels of participation that become harder and harder. So those are the things that require more persistent participation, more regular time commitments, et cetera, and more financial costs. And so you might see that. The importance of having women as candidates and office holders, of course, there is some evidence that there is a symbolic importance. In other words, seeing more women in office can make women and also other marginalized populations see this as a possibility for themselves. So we talk about it as political efficacy. And there have been some studies that show that when women are both on the ballot as well as representing you in office, that you might see greater engagement across different levels of participation by women. And that's important. We know that women don't just vote for women. They vote for the candidate who they align with most. But they certainly seem to see a positive benefit, especially in the Democratic Party, where interests often align ideologically with having and seeing more women there.
Now, you mentioned that women find ways around barriers. Are there common ways that are that women take to get around these barriers?
Well, I think it's interesting, right? Already tonight, we're seeing, for example, the Elizabeth Warren campaign gather its volunteers and figure out how to get childcare to the caucus goers, right? That's one example. So you figure it out, even though it's not a policy of the Democratic Party in Iowa to sort of organize across all the caucuses. You see women, especially women volunteers, trying to make it work and help other people out. Historically, when we've talked about women's political participation, we've talked about than being sort of do-it-yourselfers, right? Like, I'll figure out how to have an impact on this policy or on this process. And often it meant working outside of the system because women had been excluded from formal politics. So they would work in their communities. We see this especially with women of color and Black women. We will mobilize in our community. We will do volunteer efforts. We will do philanthropic efforts in order to make the sorts of policy and political change that we think is most important and to put pressure on our elected officials, even if we're going to be excluded from being those elected officials. One thing that has been interesting for organizations like ours that are trying to get more women to run for and serve in elective office is we have to sort of switch the mindset to women now and say, yes, we know you've been able to make change from the outside, but imagine how much change, more change you can make from the inside. And so all of those strategies of figuring out how to kind of go around the system have been quite effective, so effective that now we have to push women to say, look, let's figure out and break down the barriers within the system so that you can also have a seat at all of those tables.
Kelly Dittmar is an assistant professor of political science at Rutgers University and scholar at the Center for American Women in Politics. Kelly, thanks for joining us.
Thanks again for having me.
That's our show for today. Remember, you can always call us about anything at 877-8-MY-TAKE or send us a tweet at The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Arun Vanigopal in for Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway.